Okay, Ed, you ready?
I'm ready.
First edition.
First glance.
Earthrise.
At this hour.
Starting line.
The Cosmic Consciousness News Service show.
All right, so I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and I'm joined now by KPLU's Ed Ronco, who's here to help me get things off the ground. Now, what you've been hearing comes from this memo from 1979, and these were actually names that were considered and ultimately rejected for this little project that NPR was starting, what we now know of as Morning Edition.
It's hard for me to imagine a time when Morning Edition didn't exist and all these people were kind of scrambling around trying to create something new.
Yeah, I mean, these things that are so familiar to us now, at one point, they didn't exist and somebody had to birth them into the world. And that's a big deal. You know, we're going through it right now here with this new show that we're launching right here. And I got to tell you, even coming up with that name, it's a huge project. So in the interest of full disclosure, we thought we'd bring you some of our rejects.
Northwest Corner.
Pacific Daylight.
The Renaissance Radio Hour.
Cedar and Vine.
Public Market.
Face for Radio.
Huh.
Yeah, I'm not sure which one of us that was supposed to refer to.
All right, fine. But, you know, you're right, Gabe. Starting a brand new project is nerve-wracking.
Yeah, and it reminded me of something that Jad Abumrad talked about. He, of course, is the co-founder of Radiolab, and he was in town not too long ago. He was giving this talk called Gut Churn, and it was all about this peculiar experience of why creating something new could be just so deep down queasy.
I think it's about standing in the uncomfortable space long enough and just having faith that something's going to hit you in the head. Kierkegaard talked a lot about the leap of faith, and what he meant was that, like, in any sort of situation where there's a lot of freedom, by definition, you have a lot of choices, and when you make a lot of choices, you're going to kill a lot of choices that you didn't make, and the murder of all of those possibilities creates this, like, overwhelming feeling of anxiety. Like, what if I make the wrong choice? What if I don't do it right? And his idea was that the leap of faith is to simply stand in that dread and have faith that something will happen.
Okay, Ed, so you ready to murder?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so after all that, the name of our new show is Sound Effect.
Yeah, and each Saturday we're going to get together to talk about what happened over the week and then explore our region through the lens of different themes.
Yeah, and so for this one, we have a new show, new year. The theme is newness.
New planets, new kidneys, new hobbies.
Yeah, but before we get into that, we're going to bring in some fun, smart people to kind of catch us up on the news of the week. So that discussion's coming up in just a minute. In the meantime, Ed, you'd better go limber up.
Yeah, gotta stretch.
Okay, thanks, Ed. So the rest of you, stick around for an exploration of the meaning of newness. It's right here on Sound Effect on KPLU. So each show, we're going to get caught up on the news of the week by bringing in some insightful people to offer up their week's top stories and something that they think has been undercovered and something they think has been overcovered. So our first victims are here now. They are Anna Menard. She's a longtime City Hall reporter for The Stranger and an organizer for Working Washington. Rosette Royale is interim editor at Real Change. And Phyllis Fletcher is managing editor of the Northwest News Network. Hey, guys. Thanks for joining us on Sound Effect.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
So our top stories this week probably, has to be a story that's happening many thousands of miles away but has reverberations all over the place, and that, of course, is the tragic massacre in Paris at the offices of the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo. And I'm just curious how that news kind of has sunk in with you guys and how you're processing it. Of course, we're all journalists or have worked in journalism here at this table, and this is a story that it's in some ways about journalism. Anna, I wonder if we could start with you. What's been going through your head since this news broke?
Yeah, I used to work at The Stranger. I worked there for about 3 years, and that's a paper that republished the Danish cartoons of Muhammad after that controversy. So I was thinking of my colleagues and thinking of what it felt like to be in a newsroom at that moment. But it was happening on a Wednesday morning. I knew that they were probably meeting and talking about it and trying to figure out where to go from there and how you respond to that. An attack on the media means that people in the media are feeling it personally. So it becomes a different kind of story for all the reporters covering it because there's a certain amount of identification with what's happening there. So I was just thinking about that.
And Rosette, does that ring true for you too? I mean, we all must have at some time or another made somebody angry and thought about the consequences.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we think about who we're going to make angry every week, at Real Change. And, it makes me think a lot about, there was something in the New York Times where it mentioned how this incident sort of heightens the tensions between freedom of expression and the beliefs of Islamic fundamentalists. And, that makes me really nervous because I believe we're all thinking about freedom of expression, how we all want to express ourselves freely. And I think that's a great conversation for journalists to have, and it's a great conversation for readers to have as well and engage writers and journalists about.
So that's interesting because there's a lot of recriminations now about self-censorship and should we, you know, how can we kind of not live in fear? But you're saying some level, you know, this is pushing us to reflect in some ways that are not necessarily unhealthy. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think responsibility, we all need to be responsible. I mean, words have power. You know, one of the interesting things about like the response to this has been a lot of cartoons have been pencils broken, pencils that are leaking blood, right? And so it shows like the power of the image, the power of the written word. And I think as journalists, it is our responsibility to think about the word's power.
So Phyllis, what did that bring up for you? What did it bring to mind when you read that story?
Well, what came to mind when this got into the news this week was the name Molly Norris. And if you've been living in Seattle for about 5 years or so, you might remember Molly Norris as a cartoonist who used to draw for The Weekly sometimes. So when South Park, the TV cartoon show, they were going to draw Muhammad into one of their episodes, and Comedy Central backed off it. So Molly Norris drew a cartoon that, if you're secular or not Muslim, probably appeared very cute. And it was household objects asking themselves, am I Muhammad? Am I Muhammad? And over it was written, Draw Muhammad Day. And it was a satirical poster designed to encourage people to all draw Muhammad as a way to express that that should be an okay thing to do. 2 months later, she was on a hit list in the first edition of Inspire magazine, which is considered to be an Al-Qaeda publication. And she hasn't been heard from since. And probably the spookiest thing I saw during that time was an article where it was clear she was going underground. They were talking to the last people who had talked to her, and a reporter went to her house and described a blue baby swing that was hanging on a tree outside her house. And it was clear she probably had people in her life who depended on her, and that would explain why she hasn't been heard from at all.
So eerie. Well, that is a story that's unfolding, and I think we'll probably be dealing with the reverberations from that for a long time. Okay, so that's our top stories. Now, we also asked you to bring in a nominee for Overcovered Story of the Week. Phyllis, maybe we can start with you. What have you had just about enough of this week?
So what I've heard enough of this week is actually Felicia Rashad being put under the microscope for her comments about Bill Cosby. I think it's really frustrating that when you worked with someone 3 decades ago and had nothing to do with what they may or may not have done wrong, that there's a cultural expectation for you to speak out either in support of or denigrating that person.
Gotcha. The Cosby story rears its head again. So Anna Menard, what's your overcovered story of the week?
My overcovered story of the week is entirely personal. It's not any reporter's fault because this is the best story in the world to write about. But it's that toilet snake that popped out of a PR firm's toilet in San Diego. I think no stories about snakes should ever be covered anywhere because it makes my news feed completely unreadable because I'm terrified of snakes.
Rosette, I'm going to invite you to really step in it now. What's your overcovered?
Okay, this is going to make me so vilified. And so it's been nice seeing you all after I say this.
It's been nice seeing you.
Yeah, it's been nice seeing you. You know, Seahawks. You know, like, I don't have any problem with the Seahawks. Great, they won the Super Bowl. It's fantastic. That's totally awesome. But there are so many stories about, I mean, so many stories about the Seahawks. I'm waiting for the story where it's like, why this shade of green goes so well with this shade of blue.
Welcome to Sound Effects Inaugural Pariah of the Week. Well, let me just challenge you a little bit, because it is something that not only, whether you think sports is important or not, there's been like you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people turned out for that parade last year, right? It is something that affects all of us in the city in some way or another, right?
True. That's true. Actually, I had to cross the parade route to get to work that day. And I thought, oh, it's going to be fine. It's going to be no trouble. But let me tell you, that was like a battle royale.
So, okay. So if the Seahawks are squeezing out some other worthy stories, Rosette Royale, what is your undercovered story of the week?
So last August, the Burien City Council passed a resolution to ban poor and potentially offensive bodily hygiene in public spaces.
So this is making it illegal to smell bad?
It's making it illegal to smell bad, but it's not really, it wasn't really clear what bad smell was. So this happened in August. The ACLU got involved and said, you know what, that's totally unconstitutional. There was a council member, her name was Lauren Berkowitz, who was like, this is a bad idea. She voted against it, but it passed. So recently, on Monday, I believe January 5th, there was another council meeting. A lot of people went to this council meeting to complain about it. And so now the Burien City Council has removed that language from the ban, which is fantastic. But there's still other parts that are upset the ACLU, and they still feel it's unconstitutional. So there's this little battle going on in Little Burien, our little brother, and it's, you know, about freedom of expression. You know, part of the resolution is also that you can't clean yourself in a public bathroom. But then, you know, here was a part about poor bodily hygiene. So what happens if you wanted to clean yourself so that you could go out in public? But then they tell you you can't clean yourself. So it was really just, I mean, Joseph Heller, who wrote Catch-22, would have been thrilled with that sort of idea.
Well, that's a great undercover story. Phyllis Fletcher, what's your undercover story of the week?
Mine is that Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railways was telling people who had container ships to move to ports that they weren't going to take them for 3 days. And then somehow, magically, they were able to resolve it and started accepting containers again. And I still don't understand what happened. And this is all based on the disputes, the labor disputes at the ports. So all up and down the West, they were refusing containers for 3 days.
This is Sound Effect on KPLU. We're talking about our nominees for Undercover Story of the Week right now. Anna Menard, what's your choice?
My choice, again, is not entirely fair because I don't think people have had a chance to cover this yet. But I just would really like to see housing affordability in Seattle be the big story of the year.
Yes, Anna. Yes, yes, yes.
Rosette is literally raising his fist.
Yes, yeah. So cheerleading in the room. I just want to see that be as big as the minimum wage was last year. And I mean, like, it seems like it's a good thing that the City Hall is focusing on it, and I'm glad to see that. But I want to see the media also holding their feet to the fire.
Well, we'll definitely be keeping an eye on the coverage. Sorry, Anna, that we won't have you to be covering it in City Hall. Is it giving you the itch a little bit? Or?
It really is. I had no idea how much I would miss harassing the entirety of City Hall whenever I had the opportunity. Now I can only do it on Twitter. That's really tragic.
Harangue from
me.
The sidelines.
Call him out right here on the radio now.
Hey, guys, I miss you.
Yeah.
So here for our first show, our first inaugural installment of Sound Effect, our theme this week is newness. And so I wanted to just ask you guys if you would be willing to share one new thing you would like to try this year. Phyllis Fletcher?
I can share one new thing I didn't want to try that I did try this week. Smelly fog. It was so gross. I mean, I was so this was Tuesday night. Normally, I would not be out and about on a Tuesday night, but I had some errands I had to run after my son went to bed. And so I was running those errands, and I could not believe how bad it smelled. And I have to say, I was gratified to have it discussed the next morning and then explained as being some like weather inversion thing, that it wasn't just me. I was not imagining it. But one of the things it brought home, to go back to your point, Rosette, we're all responsible for how everything smells. That's basically the takeaway from that experience, is that it was the weather system was basically putting a cap on the city, and we were all experiencing our own pollution.
Well, Rosette Royale, what's something new you are intending to try this time around?
Well, okay, I've already tried it, but I tend to really, really try it. So a month ago, I went to Mexico, and I went to a market in this town, Tepoztlan, and it was a vegetarian market, a stand, and I was like, wow, and the woman was speaking so quickly, I couldn't understand her. So I just said, yeah, see. And so she gave me some food, and it was this little potato patty that had crickets inside of it.
Oh.
And I didn't know that it had crickets inside it until I bit into it and had a little cricket leg in my teeth.
Oh, dear.
And I had this moment where, like, I went, what do I do? What do I do? What do I do? And so I decided, well, it's in your mouth, so you chew it. And so I chewed, and then I just ate it. And it wasn't bad, really. It wasn't bad. So I decided, okay, you know, I'm going to actually be intentional and eat crickets, like eat bugs. I've been hearing people eat like bugs, right? And so I found out from a friend that Central Co-op has crickets. You can buy them, and you can buy cricket flour. And so I'm going to try eating crickets on a semi-regular basis.
Wow.
I know a guy. Old.
Okay. Thank you. I thought you were going to say I know a cricket.
Anna Menard, what's your new thing you'd like to try this year?
Yeah, this year. I have heard for a while about people stopping drinking in January, not drinking any alcohol in January, and calling it Dry-nuary. And it sounds like a great way to start off the new year being a little more healthy and a little more intentional. And I am pretty excited to do that, except I am not doing it in January because January is a long month. I'm doing it in February because February has fewer days and I can do math. So I think I can make it through February. But it's an interesting thing. I've heard people have a really good experience with like, hey, I'm just going to just cut this out and have socializing that doesn't involve alcohol every time.
So this month is sort of hair of the doggy-wary.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Hair of the doggy-wary and then dry-buary or something like that. Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much. Anna Menard, Rosette Royale, Phyllis Fletcher. You guys have been great sports. We really appreciate you being part of our inaugural panel here on Sound Effect.
All right. Fun.
Hey, thank you. Take care.
This is Sound Effect on 88.5 KPLU. You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this week we're exploring the theme of newness. So that got us thinking about new discoveries, and well, what's the most stupendous thing you could possibly discover? A new world.
At first I thought, I mean, as with many women in science, I thought I'm making a mistake. You know, like I'm not smart enough to be doing this right.
That's Dr. Sarah Ballard. She's an astrophysicist, and what she didn't think she was smart enough to find was an exoplanet. This is a planet outside of our solar system that orbits distant stars. And so at one point she has sort of plopped on her desk this chunk of data, because this is how we find exoplanets these days. And this data represented a piece of sky that had been observed by this satellite-based telescope. So she had to kind of root through all this data to find evidence of a new planet. And she found one. It was called Kepler-19b, and she was looking at it very, very carefully and discovered that it wasn't really behaving right. Sometimes it would show up a little earlier than she was expecting, and sometimes it would show up a little later than expecting. And it was this sort of mystery that she puzzled over and over, and then she finally had this revelation. Perhaps what she was seeing was evidence of a second planet, an invisible planet. And if that were true, that would be a huge deal, because one of these had not been found in quite this way ever before. So she got all excited, but then immediately, when you're a scientist, when you get excited, you also get skeptical, right? You have to do kind of a gut check. So she went down the hall and visited with this colleague, and together they tried to figure out whether it was for real.
We puzzled over the figure, and we thought we tried to brainstorm ways that it could be a false positive. But we couldn't figure out a way that it was definitively wrong.
So that left her with the distinct possibility that she was definitively right. So she takes all that information, plows it into an email, and sends it off to kind of the A-team. These are the NASA experts who can really parse her work and figure out if she's onto something or not. And in the meantime, you know, Sarah's in grad school. She's a young person. She has a life. And she had plans that evening. She was headed out to a concert, actually a Seattle band, the Fleet Foxes. So she sends off the email, grabs her phone, and heads out to the show. And while she's there, she's glued to her phone, and she's refreshing like crazy. Refresh, refresh, refresh. And what she was waiting for was definitive word whether or not she had blown it or whether she, Sarah Ballard, had actually discovered a new world.
We were actually sitting in the very, very back, the very last row of the theater. So it was me and my friend. I didn't want to be rude. I mean, you're at a concert. You don't want to be constantly checking your phone. So what I would do is, at the end of sort of a set of a few songs, I would hold my hand over the screen and kind of read it. So the first email that I saw was my advisor himself. And he proposed a lot of the things that postdoc and I, he proposed the things we thought of. And so I was actually responding in real time. I would kind of write back like, well, I did this with the modeling procedure, and I think that's pretty above board, all these things. And ultimately, there was a man who wrote, and he was from the transit timing variation team. And he said, I think this is a real thing. And moreover, we've seen hints of this already. At this point, the concert was almost over, and I felt nauseated with emotion about it. In very intense moments, even if the moments are very joyful, sometimes people just feel like they want to barf. That is how I felt. I was sick. I don't know how I slept that night. I think I thought, I just can't wait for tomorrow. I can't believe it's real.
So what's it like to have the first glimpse into a piece of nature?
It feels like very human. I think you can imagine that it would feel almost superhuman, I think, as how people imagine you would have this moment of discovery and it would transcend the banal. And in truth, what it felt like was joy, and it felt like validation. It felt like validation because it was very linked to a feeling of self-worth, whether I had been pursuing this field, could I make any kind of incremental advance in it?
So much of science are these incremental advances.
Yeah,
and right. So much of it is so
but
esoteric.
Could I do it? Right.
But you got to discover something that's not just a little wobble in a number,
yeah,
or something that you couldn't possibly make
yeah
my mother understand. You discovered a planet.
I did discover a planet. Yeah, that's true.
But you didn't feel you didn't feel godlike necessarily.
People usually ask, did you get to name it? Okay, so that's kind of getting at something similar. Did you feel a profound sense of ownership and discovery? And kind of makes you feel insignificant a little bit. At the very least, you don't feel a sense of ownership. And it's a thing which is so far away. You feel the excitement of observing something in nature, sort of like seeing something really beautiful happen with animals or something. But it's not really about you. I don't know how else to describe it. I'm sure people do feel that way, because it's I found something. I would be the kind of person, if I went to the moon, I wouldn't bring the American flag. I don't get it. But I understand people do feel that way. They want to plant their flag.
It sounds like you felt humble, if anything else.
I did feel humble. Yeah, I felt humbled, but I felt like I could proudly take my place among other scientists who got to feel humbled by the magnificence of the universe. Before that, I felt like I wasn't a part of that club, because that's something entirely different. You can look at other scientists and really admire how they conduct themselves and how they get to find all this cool stuff and they get to talk to people about it. And you can feel actually very apart. And that's usually how many young scientists feel, especially young women. You feel kind of like you're not one of the movers and shakers. And I felt like I got to be part of the club. And if I were part of the club, I would still be Sarah. I wouldn't be kind of wanting to plant my flag or something. I'd be the same old Sarah. But I felt like maybe I could do it. And that was an identity moment, which is funny because it's truly about something which is 300 light years away. And it affected my life.
Do you ever put yourself there? Mm-hmm. Do you think about what these planets are like? You've now discovered four of them.
Yeah.
So do you think about them or speculate about them or just imagine? Do you let yourself go there?
Yeah, I really try to put myself there. It would be the kind of thing that you would think about in the morning when you're kind of just staring out the window. Often, like most people, I'm thinking about other stuff. But sometimes I do wonder things that we would consider everyday things, like an ocean, a distant ocean lapping in a distant shore. You try to imagine what that would be like. Sometimes think about that. Almost never talk about it, though. So it's a pleasure to kind of talk about it because that's really not the scientific way of explaining things. I'm very used to talking about planets in terms of numbers. And I'm actually used to thinking about them in terms of career stuff. Such and such a planet opened such and such a door. You kind of distance yourself from the fact that it's a world. I'm trying to imagine that these planets are places. They really are places where one could stand.
That's Dr. Sarah Ballard. She is a Carl Sagan Fellow at the University of Washington, where she works in astrophysics. And she's the discoverer of four new worlds, including my personal favorite, Kepler 19c, the invisible planet. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and I'm joined now by our buddy Ed Ronco. We are talking about newness this week and what it feels like to do something new or try something new, discover something new. Ed, we sent you out to do something you'd never done before. First of all, why did we put you through this exactly?
All right, so the idea was that I should experience something new for all of its fun, but also for all of its incredible discomfort, right? And to understand what it's like when you try something new, especially as an adult, when you haven't maybe done anything new in a long time.
Okay, so what did you try?
I tried tap dancing.
Right. 1, 2, here we go.
I took my lesson from a guy named Anthony Peters. He's been tap dancing for 40 years. He runs his own studio called Tap Dance Seattle. It's up in the Green Lake neighborhood.
So there you go. You did it. You're a tap dancer. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yes, quarter notes. Very, very complicated. It got a lot harder. That was just the warm-up we were listening to there.
I'm having fun picturing this in my mind's eye.
All I'm thinking right now is flat, 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 flat. We did that over and over, up and down the floor.
How did it feel to do something new? Was it, did it feel unfamiliar? Was it alien or how did it feel?
It was totally alien because you think you know how to do this. They're my feet. I use them every day. I walk. I know how to walk. I've been able to walk for 31 years. But you add one little variable, one little change, and it throws the whole system off. We tried something called a cramp roll.
I like trying moves that have the name of the painful part in the name of the move.
Yeah, so this is Anthony demonstrating the cramp roll. And here I am.
Da, 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 da.
I'm not laughing at you. I'm laughing like near you.
Once again, Anthony and me. He taught this combination thing with steps and ball changes and shuffles, and there was some syncopation in there. We set it to music, and it wasn't half bad, really.
1, 2, and here we go. And take it on home.
Of course, saying it wasn't half bad also means it was half bad.
So I think, when you're a little kid, like you try things all the time, new things you've never done before, and you have to be kind of, encouraged by your parents, your teachers, your coaches, or whatever. As grown-ups, we often we'll go long stretches without doing something outside of our comfort zone. What was that like for you?
I tend to like being able to succeed immediately at whatever I try. And it was really hard to embrace the fact that I'm going to fail. There's no way I'm going to tap dance with any even shred of ability. As a little kid, you're not as exposed to the shame of failure, right? It's just a thing. It's just, oh, I tried it. It didn't work. When you're a grown up, you're supposed to try things. They're supposed to work. You're supposed to be competent. And Anthony talked about that a little bit. We asked him about something new that he's recently tried.
Well, last January, I started studying Italian. That was new for me.
And he says that that helps him have a lot of compassion for his students.
Learning something new is hard, especially as an adult. And a lot of the adults who come to my class, they are already accomplished people in other fields. And so they see me tap dancing, and so I've been doing it for 40 years. I can make it look pretty easy. So then they think it's easy. But it's actually not.
It's not at all. I learned 3 basic moves in an hour. I mastered absolutely none of them, but I did have fun. And I learned that I need to have a lot more patience with myself and with the notion that I'm not going to necessarily succeed. But that doesn't mean that I will never succeed, right?
And someday you may indeed sound like Anthony. Ed Astaire Ronco, a contributor to our program. Thank you so much for putting yourself out there, Ed.
My pleasure. Thanks, Gabe.
You're listening to Sound Effect from KPLU. Welcome back. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and for the first installment of our new show in a new year, we are digging into this idea of newness, what it means to be new, to try something new, to get something new. And as we've heard, newness can be exhilarating or it can be nerve-wracking, but it's also got this other side too, a kind of a melancholy side. And to talk about that, I'm joined now by KPLU's Nick Morrison. Hey, Nick.
Good morning.
So you talked to this author who is originally from Seattle, Charles D'Ambrosio, and he's a guy you've been following for a while now, huh?
Yes. He was born and raised here, and when he first started writing, when he first started publishing, his work appeared in The Stranger, and since then he's written four books, short stories and essays, and he has a new book of essays out called Loitering, and in that book of essays is an essay on newness.
Yeah, it's called American Newness. It's this very interesting reflection on what the idea of newness is and how seductive it can be, but in some cases maybe how empty?
Well, yeah, empty's the word, because he was sent out on assignment to do an article on modular homes, prefab homes, and they're empty when he's in them and cogitating on them. So he went out with the greatest intentions to write this essay and just kind of got lost in the newness.
All right, well, we're going to hear a reading from that essay, American Newness, from his new collection, Loitering.
Right inside the door of my first Fleetwood home, I was greeted by the evocative odor of American newness, that smell everyone knows but cannot name. It was like breaking the seal on a box and getting a whiff of what? Of exactly what you always wanted. I know I got doped up on the smell and instantly forgot the facts of my life for the fantasy it might become. The walls in the homes I had toured had the texture of those egg-shaped confections of sugar that housed dioramic Easter scenes of bunnies and baby chickens. The walls didn't look entirely dry, as though you might sink your finger in for a lick of buttercream frosting. They were immaculate and white, and somehow against this backdrop, even normal objects seemed like miniatures, not quite real and thus easily manageable. All the rooms were furnished by a hired decorator, but felt empty. What they were missing was you, and yet it was haunting to confront a face in a mirror. Suddenly you were there, arrived and occupying a place in this world premised on choice, where everything exists as potential, where the deep pile carpet on the floor is only a polite suggestion and might, in a moment's wish, become adobe, cameo blush, cabernet, cinnabar, periwinkle, or Napa Valley. The formica on the counter could be traded for squares of blue tile. The fridge will find food. The quiet will find voices. The beds will bring rest and love and renewal. To make a manufactured home, first you build the chassis with axles. After you've put the chassis in place, you glue and staple the flooring to it with extra big boards that cut down on the number of seams and hence reduce the likelihood of leakage. As it's being built, the house floats like a river barge on a bed of compressed air. A couple men lean into it with their shoulders and shove it from one station to the next as if it were nothing. Exterior walls go up, interior walls. Men plumb the thing, run wires, install fixtures. They add windows, hang doors. A roof is lowered in place by an erector set crane. Appliances, cabinets, fans, and carpets are readied. Out of this wizardly and truly awesome Oz, the house is wheeled into the daylight and trucked away to whatever Kansas your heart desires. I made a couple of trips to the factory in a dirt lot nearby where Fleetwood showcases their finished product. And lastly, I started looking for places where I could find people living in the houses for real. Several detours off Interstate 5 showed me how rapidly a community seeded with modular housing can grow. Everything's so brand new, there isn't even any sound in the air. In one such neighborhood off Gun Club Road in Woodland, Washington, I parked my truck and tried to talk to some kids coming home from school, but they were right on it with the snappy, drilled response. "Are you a stranger?" one girl wanted to know. "What's a stranger?" I asked. "Somebody who kills you or rapes you," she said. I'm not that kind of stranger, but it might have been here, in this neighborhood, in this place where the children know what to say, that a note of sorrow first entered the world of hope I'd been entertaining during my initial home tour.
That's Charles D'Ambrosio reading from his essay, American Newness. And he and Nick Morrison talked a little more at length about some of the ideas that he brings up in that essay and why these new homes kind of rang hollow for him.
One of the overarching things I was getting out of reading the story is that you entered the assignment with a very high heart. It feels to me like you really wanted you really wanted to like these places.
I did, and maybe, you know, like even more precisely, I wanted to resolve my ambivalence about them with something positive, I suppose. I wanted to like them, but I wanted to like them kind of in a way that snuck up on me, that was kind of personal. A thing that goes unmentioned kind of in the essay is that, I was just, the conditions of my life were such that I didn't really have much of a place. I didn't have, a sense of real possibility. So, all the homes became kind of a vessel for my dreaming in a way that kind of surprised me.
And yet you couldn't love them. There was just something so not there, or what?
It was more like a kind of mixed feeling. There was a kind of an attempt to come up with something that resembled something real. They resemble homes. They hit all the high notes, all the marks. And so even inside these brand new manufactured homes, there's almost a nostalgia for a certain idea of what home means. And I think we all, for most people, probably it's not really even a nostalgia. It's a reality. That's what home means. And the attempt to manufacture that, put a certain kind of twist on my perception of it.
The fact that these things are manufactured, so manufactured, could there possibly have been anything done with them, to them, that would have made them more, or made it more real to you?
I don't think so, because I don't think you're being sold a dream, basically. I mean, to put it kind of, just crudely, dreams aren't for sale. I mean, I could imagine buying into the dream, and then I could imagine buying that home or any home, and then instantly you're confronted with certain realities. But the promise and the premise of these manufactured homes, at least in this initial stage, is that will never happen, and in fact, it always happens.
Was there any appeal to the newness? I guess just as newness.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. Some of the appeal of the newness is a new beginning, and some of the promise, I think, that's being held out. You don't know, you bring your entire history, but these places were strangely without history, and the appeal is somehow that American thing, that ability to remake yourself without social constraint, without, the baggage of history. It's all premised on kind of a futurity, I suppose. It's a heavy dose of it, and somehow that we will be free of the errant wanderings of history as soon as we buy that new home. It doesn't have to be, I was writing about manufactured homes, and I don't want to be, slamming them. I think the purchase of any home is kind of premised in that way, but they were in the business of manufacturing and selling that dream. But yeah, newness itself, which is like scary too. One of the things that I felt in entering all of those homes is not so much exactly newness, but that time itself had stopped or been drained out of the equation. No one would ever be tired. No one would ever be hungry. No one would ever be mad. There would never be any shouting. There would never be any losses. So time itself had been sucked out of it.
Author Charles D'Ambrosio speaking with KPLU's Nick Morrison. So as we've been hearing, getting something new, often it feels like a luxury, something extra, something maybe you don't really need. But there are times when it is something you need, something you really, really need, like life or death. So we're about to meet Leila Mirhadari. She lives in Gig Harbor, and 3 years ago she was a student at Washington State University, and she was getting her degree in wildlife biology, and she had started to feel kind of sick. She didn't have much energy, she was noticing that she was bruising easily. And then she woke up one day and discovered that there were these big gray spots in her field of vision, and her eyes were kind of blurry.
went to optometrist. He took pictures of the back of my eye, told me that they were bleeding. Then next day went in, got lab work done. That night around 10:30, I got a call from the lab tech saying I needed to get into a hospital, that he couldn't tell me what was going on, but it had something to do with my kidneys.
So she went back to the hospital there in Pullman, got, you know, poked, prodded, more lab work done, and finally the doctor gave her the news.
The physician came in, sat down quietly, and told me that my kidneys had failed, that I had, you know, maybe about 5% left. I didn't know if I was going to live to see tomorrow, or I was an organ failure.
So this, as you might expect, was something of a shock, because I don't know if I mentioned this, but she was only 27 years old, and that just doesn't happen to 27-year-olds. You don't just go into organ failure for no reason. And it has remained kind of a mystery. No one's quite sure what happened to her kidneys. As best she can figure out, you know, she had had the swine flu some months earlier, and it's possible that infection kind of bounced around inside her body. But the bottom line was she needed help, and she needed it right away.
So they were like, you need dialysis, and you need it now.
Dialysis.
Yes.
So that was a new word to you then?
Yes. Yes. I had no idea what the world of dialysis meant.
Yeah. So what does it mean? To describe it for somebody who's never had the pleasure.
Well, there's two different kinds of dialysis. Hemodialysis, which is, you know, a blood cleansing. And then there's peritoneal dialysis, where you use a catheter put in my abdomen and a fluid exchange. But you go in center, you go three times a week. I went in like Monday, Wednesday, Friday for 3 to 4 hours, and you sit in a chair and, you know, blood's being pumped out of you and going through this artificial filter and then being pumped back in you.
So in center, that means you go into a special place.
Right.
Doctors and nurses do this stuff for you. But
right.
Then eventually this whole operation came home with you, right?
Correct. Yeah. And so after about a couple months of being in center, once my catheter healed, I went through about 2.5 months of training where I went in multiple times a week. You learn, you know, everything there is to learn to be your own nurse at home. Yeah.
So walk me through it. Like, what was your routine like, and how often did you have to do it?
So I did it every day. 8 hours a night, I would have tucked up to my machine.
While you're sleeping?
Yes, or try to sleep is what I always told people. You know, you can feel the pressure of fluid being put in and out of your stomach. So,
Is it cold?
It isn't, because the machine had a warmer. But if it was ever cold, you could instantly feel it. You would cramp, and it would be very uncomfortable. But I would normally have around 2 liters in my abdomen, you know, at a time. So that's a lot of fluid. You know, sometimes I would feel like I would look, you know, like 6 months pregnant, but it would just be all fluid that would be in my stomach, you know, and you kind of feel full and uncomfortable.
What was this like for you, just to experience this, particularly as a person? And I mean, it couldn't be fun for anybody, but no. For somebody in her late 20s,
right.
How did it feel? And how did it feel watching all your peers not going through that?
Right. It was hard at first. I was definitely jealous of a lot of my friends that, you know, if we would go out or have a good time. I was also on a very strict diet, so there were things that I couldn't eat. I didn't have a lot of energy. I always felt kind of ill and sick. So that, yeah, it was hard. And then my friends could just go home and crash on their bed or crash on the couch, and you know, they didn't have that huge responsibility when they got home.
Yeah, it's not like you could just flop over on the Lazy Boy
no.
and fall asleep for the night.
No. No, it would take probably about a good half an hour or so just to say, okay, now I can go to bed.
How long did that go on?
For 3 years.
Did you feel chained to this thing?
Oh, yeah. In the absolute physical sense of it, yes. Because once you hook up to your dialysis machine, you really have maybe enough tether to get to the bathroom, if that's it. So once I would be on this machine for 8 hours, I couldn't leave the bedroom.
So all that time, you were, of course, waiting for another kidney,
yes.
A new kidney.
Yes.
Right? So how did that work exactly?
Yes, it's this, you know, this phantom thing that you never know is going to come, but you just have to have hope that one day, you know, this magical kidney will come. And, of course, the wait in Washington is around 2 to 3 years, which is actually pretty good considering there's some states that can be up to 5 to 7 years. So then I kind of thought, hey, you know, maybe I should start looking for a living donor. And how do you ask somebody, hey, can I have your kidney? It's kind of an interesting intro to a conversation. Had a couple people come forward, but weren't really that serious. And then luckily in November of last year, I guess you could call him my step cousin, had seen what I was going through and was like, hey, I'd love to help.
What's a step cousin?
So he's my stepfather's stepsister's son. So yeah, no blood relation. he was just really adamant. He would joke with me and said he had the best kidney this side of the Mississippi and that he wanted to give it to me. Yeah.
How did it play out?
So obviously well, very well. I received his kidney on September 9th. But, you know, I remember we were in pre-op and everything, and I'm sure I had this huge smile on my face. And I was it was such an emotional couple of days because it was the culmination of something that you want and you wish for every day. You wake up and, man, what I would do and give to have to just be healthy. But yeah, I remember getting wheeled into the operating room and I had this like cheesy smile on my face and the anesthesiologist like, are you okay? And I was like, yeah, when I wake up, I'm getting a kidney. Like, I'm going to go to bed and I'm going to wake up and I'm going to have this kidney. And he's like, okay, but breathe. A few minutes later, you know, I was out and woke up and there it was.
I don't know what it's like to come out of anesthesia, but okay. Did you know where you were right away?
And... Oh, yes. Yes. And I instantly knew that. Like, okay, if all went well, there's a kidney in there. It all went well.
Did you have to ask? Or you're like, is it in there?
Yeah, I was like, is it there? Like, you know, I
feeling
looked,
around.
Yeah, I was like, wait, are there stitches? Oh, okay, there's stitches. That's a good thing.
Wow. And so, how as you kind of came down from that euphoria, like, what was going through your mind about having this new part of your body?
Just so excited. So excited and elated and grateful, obviously, for my donor and doing this beautiful selfless act of his to help someone who was in need. And I mean, you know, he basically saved my life.
Does the organ feel like yours?
Yes and no.
Well, let me ask you a different way. Does it feel like you?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I've fondly named it the Hulk. Because it's such, it's very big and works wonderfully. My donor was a good sized guy, so he had a nice, big, healthy kidney. And it's funny because it's in the front, so I feel it. It's, you know.
Oh, you can feel it with your hand?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Get out.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. So do you unconsciously kind of touch it, or do you when you're thinking about it, do you reach down a little bit?
Yeah, both. And sometimes I just kind of hold it and just say thank you. Thanks, new friend, for doing all the good work that you're doing down there.
Leila Mirhadari and the Hulk live in Gig Harbor, where she's working on healing and advocating for organ donation. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. Sound Effect is produced by Arwin Nix with Kevin Kniestad. Ed Ronco tapped his way into our hearts and ears today. Thanks for that, Ed. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. KPLU's general manager is Joey Cohn. Special thanks to Martha Kang, Brenda Goldstein-Young, Justin Steyer, and the peripatetic Nick Morrison. Hope you enjoyed our first episode of Sound Effect. You can hear more at kplu.org. Join us next week when we meet a few rule breakers.
It's a story of a woman who broke all the rules, many laws, and most of the commandments, and in the end, broke the rules of the rule breakers themselves.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer. You're listening to KPLU.